Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
This is New Books in National Security, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Beth Windisch. Today I'm joined by Michael Desch, who wrote the book Cult of the Irrelevant, The Waning Influence of Social Science on National Security. Michael Desch is the Packy J.D. Professor of International Relations in the Department of Political Science and the Director of the International Security Center at the University of Notre Dame. He was the founding director of the Scowcroft Institute of International Affairs and the first holder of the Robert M. Gates Chair in Intelligence and National Security Decision-Making at the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. Mike, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Beth.
In Cult of the Irrelevant, you describe a gap between policymakers and international relations scholars. How did you become interested in that gap? And how did you come to research and write this book?
Well, I've been a practicing political scientist for about 30 years. And actually, I got interested in this business precisely because it was a way to balance both sustained engagement with concrete real world issues. You know, at the time I was in high school and college, the Cold War was raging, and national security issues had more than a little pressing relevance to our lives. But I also was interested in not just becoming a bureaucrat, but also trying to think about these issues from a little bit of a remove. My image of being a professor interested in national security issues was very much shaped by the memory of the golden age of early Cold War national security studies, where you had towering figures like Bernard Brody, Albert Volstetter, and especially Thomas Schelling, who managed to keep a foot in both the ivory tower and inside the beltway. And so I thought getting into the business in the late 1980s, early 1990s, if I could do the same thing, I would be a very happy man. And I want to be clear, I've had a great career and enjoyed it every step along the way. But one of the things I discovered was that the golden age figure's ability to balance the requirements of academia with, what was going on in the policy world was fast becoming a thing of the past. And it was harder and harder to do both, in a way that they had done it before. So it's both a historical reflection on an era that has passed in many respects, but also an analytical undertaking to try to figure out why that happened and assess the consequences of it. You know, should we feel nostalgic for the golden age period, or should we say, we've moved a lot since then and things are for the better?
You argue that the decline of policy relevance of academic work in security studies is a result of the professionalization of political science.
Right.
Can you tell us about what you found? And are you coming to take away all of our quantitative methods and our numbers?
Well, what I found is that the academy, much like any other large and complex organization, tends, as a result of its normal functioning, to become more inwardly focused and preoccupied. And in a way, that's a result of both the, you know, normal functioning of science, but also it's also the normal dynamics of bureaucratic politics. So this preoccupation with ourselves as profession that defines what it works on and how it works on those things by its own standards is, in a way, a ubiquitous phenomenon. It's like the law or the medicine or engineering. It's not unusual. And in some respects, it's a good thing. I mean, the professionalization of the discipline of political science, the self-conscious reflection on methodology, the attempt to use the most advanced and precise tools of social analysis has, in many respects, produced important progress in the field. And that's all for the good. But what I do in The Cult of the Irrelevant is two things. First is to show that the professionalization of the discipline has also had a downside. And the downside is the more we gaze at our own navels, the less likely we are to engage in topics that the rest of society thinks are absolutely important. And by doing so, I think we both hurt ourselves if we become viewed, as I think we are by a lot of people outside the discipline, as being lotus eaters and not really doing work that speaks to broader audiences. The support that we can expect from members of Congress and the general public is going to continue to decline. Secondly, I also think that theory that's well-grounded in the real world, and particularly in terms of the policy issues that policymakers and the public are concerned about, also produces better scholarship. I mean, you know, at a certain point, being close to what's happening in the real world is absolutely critical for sound theorizing. And if you're close to issues in the real world, you're also close to being able to say something about policy making, in my judgment.
You trace the history of security studies as an academic discipline, but also the parallel development of the use of social science by government in the national security space. Can you talk about these early beginnings and how they continue to affect security studies today?
Well, I talk in the early chapters of the book about the beginning of the professionalization of the social sciences, particularly the discipline of political science, my discipline. And basically what I point out is that my discipline was born at the beginning of the 20th century, and it had at its beginnings a dual commitment to both being a science, but also a science that was relevant to the policy concerns that were at the top of the agenda during that particular period of time. And it really, you know, the early part of the 20th century was the high point of the progressive era, in which there was great confidence that the expertise of the academy and the needs of the rest of society were easily reconcilable. But from the very beginning, it became clear that there were tensions between these two objectives. And the figure for me who sort of epitomizes those tensions was the political science professor from the University of Chicago, Charles Merriam, who was committed to trying to advance both of these goals, but found very quickly that he had to make a choice between one or the other. And in fact, the period between the First World War and the Second World War was the very beginnings of the effort to craft a new science of political science. And Merriam and some of his colleagues were in the forefront of that effort. And as a result of the sort of pushing and hauling between Merriam and other political scientists like Charles Beard, who took a different view, was much more interested in making political science an instrument for dealing with society's problems, the scientists won out. And science became defined as an objective enterprise that was all about pursuing knowledge for knowledge's sake. And it was not only a decision to emphasize basic research, but also the idea that in trying to influence policy, somehow it would corrupt the scientific process became deeply ingrained in the DNA of professional social science. So social science and its effort to professionalize very quickly took the discipline in the direction of eschewing applied research. Now, the subfield of security studies, which also was born in the interwar period, had a much closer alignment with policymaking. It, you know, started in the early 1930s and really hit its stride during World War II. And then, of course, with the outbreak of the Cold War in the late 1940s, prolonged period of pretty intense international security conflict and rivalry, security studies gravitated, or at least maintained, the commitment to being both a rigorous social science, but also one that was relevant to concrete policy. And that sort of made it neither fish nor fowl, in the sense that the rest of the discipline of political science, which security studies had been most closely aligned with, was moving in a very different direction. And so during periods of war or sustained international conflict, security studies in the academy was able to get away with straddling the fence. But it was during periods of peace that the tensions between being a rigorous social science and being policy relevant came back to the fore. And the rest of the discipline of political science became far less sympathetic to security studies' effort to, you know, maintain a foot in both camps.
You discuss the Vietnam War in some detail, and the Vietnam War is a time where social science had high relevance with policymakers but poor results. How did your findings related to the Vietnam War shape your research?
Well, I think there was broad recognition that, you know, sometime in the 1960s, the gap between academic social science and the policy world had begun to widen. And that led a lot of people to speculate that it was primarily the result of political controversy associated with the war, and particularly with the significant cooperation between social scientists interested in security issues and the Pentagon and the intelligence community and other parts of government. And I don't want to argue that the political controversy associated with the Vietnam War played no role in the estrangement of academia and government in the national security realm. But what I point out in the book is that the key mechanism for this estrangement was not just political reaction to the war, but had much deeper roots. And the deeper roots, of course, were the effort to craft a science of politics, particularly in the early Cold War period as a result of the behavioral revolution in political science. So in other words, the gap began before the war
you know, became very controversial on campus, and the mechanisms driving the two realms apart had less to do with political conflict and more to do with professionalization of the discipline.
The Pentagon Papers offered a unique view at the policymaking process. How did that allow you to evaluate relevance, and is it possible to continue to evaluate relevance in the national security space where many parts of the policymaking process may be classified?
Well, the answer to the latter question is yes. And as you see in the concluding substantive chapter of the book, Chapter 8, I talk about post-Vietnam efforts, some of which continued through the war on terrorism and 9/11 and the U.S. military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's possible to trace, you know, the continuing efforts of some people to bridge the gap right up into the present. Now, the period before the Vietnam War, in the early years of American involvement in Vietnam, is very well documented. And of course, the Pentagon Papers were only the tip of the iceberg, as it were, although, as you saw in my book, they were important in terms of tracing the impact of academic social science on government thinking about nation building and counterinsurgency. But there were a lot of other documents, including unpublished documents, that were quite helpful in giving me a sort of fine-grained sense about how policymakers were reaching out to scholars and how they were trying to use scholarly expertise to help them figure out how to, if not win, at least not lose the war in Vietnam. And the two key figures I talk about during that period are the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs under Kennedy and Johnson, John McNaughton, who was a Harvard law school professor, and his good friend, the Nobel economist, Thomas Schelling. And I have McNaughton's unpublished diaries during that period that show his regular meetings with Schelling at critical junctures in which he's helping to make some of the most important decisions about U.S. policy in Vietnam.
Speaking of Schelling, the influence of economics and its associated methods on security studies are huge. Can you talk about that influence and the pros and cons to adopting an economics framework to evaluate national security issues?
Yeah, I mean, economics is the red thread running through the history of the professionalization of political science throughout the period since the end of the Second World War. And it's really an interesting case because in the economic realm, academic economics, which is highly quantitative and highly formalized, has managed to maintain the balance between rigor and relevance in a much less troublesome way than other social science disciplines. And I think that just has to do with the nature of the issues that economics deals with. It's a phenomenon that are easily quantifiable and over which individuals most closely approximate the rational decision-making process at the center of so many economic models. Now, the success of economics has been for political science a bit of a siren song in the sense that if the economists can do this, why can't we do it as well? And so in the early 1950s and through the 60s, there was a lot of interest in exploring how economic techniques and theories might be transferred to the national security realm. And Schelling, I think, was probably one of the most important figures in that effort, both at the RAND Corporation, this very interesting federally funded research and development center that the Air Force set up to try to, bridge the gap between the two worlds. You know, there was a period of time, I think, when the marriage of economics and security studies was quite fruitful. And I think Schelling's work on nuclear deterrence, especially in the late 1950s, was certainly illustrative of the compatibility between the two approaches. But the guy, I think, who's more typical of the process of political science, you know, being initially enamored of the economic approach, trying it out, and then very quickly realizing its limitations, was the political science scientist Bernard Brody, who was also at RAND for a long time, including overlapping with Schelling there, but subsequently Brody finished his career at UCLA in the Department of Political Science. And Brody went from being very bullish on the marriage of economics and security studies in the 50s to being quite skeptical in the 60s and 70s that that was a marriage that was bound to last. And I think just to, you know, sort of make simple a long and convoluted process, but Brody came to think that the issues that economists dealt with and the issues that security specialists dealt with were in many ways apples and oranges. And the idea that there would be one social science that would be applicable to all the different fields of the social sciences, including international security, became less and less persuasive to him. And that was as a result of, you know, being somebody at a place like RAND who was constantly trying to apply the techniques and approaches of economics to real-world national security policy problems.
Following World War II, there's a debate going on over the funding of social sciences by the National Science Foundation. Can you talk about that debate and perhaps how that tracks with historic tensions between natural sciences and social sciences?
Sure. The story of the establishment of the National Science Foundation, and particularly the uncertain role of the social sciences in it, is absolutely central to my story of how the social sciences became less and less eager to immerse themselves in policy-relevant research. And the story basically goes like this. Vannevar Bush, who was a natural scientist and was also FDR and Harry Truman's science advisor, was very eager after the end of World War II to find a mechanism by which government would continue to support scientific research broadly defined in the university world. During the war, there had been a lot of government support for work that was being done in the natural sciences in the university because this work was often relevant to the advancing the war effort. So Bush wanted to, and many other natural scientists wanted to continue that after the end of the war. But that effort became politically controversial in Congress because the members of Congress, or many members of Congress, were in principle willing to support scientific research, but they wanted a payoff for it. They wanted work that was directed towards concrete real-world problems that they could explain to their constituents why it was necessary for federal funds to be going in this direction. But Bush and many other natural scientists didn't want a bunch of congressmen telling them what sort of research they should be doing. So they pushed a scientific purist stance that science was all about basic research and knowledge for knowledge's sake. And that was the sort of research that the National Science Foundation should be supporting. So Bush, in a sense, won that fight, and the NSF became focused on supporting basic research for the most part. But then that raised the question among many of the natural scientists about whether social science could be considered scientific in the same way that the natural sciences were. And many natural scientists were skeptical about the social sciences. Some just thought that they were not scientific in the same way that the natural sciences were. But others were more concerned about the political controversy that social science often engendered. And their view was, you know, maybe you can make social science scientific in the way we understand science, but so many of the issues that the social sciences look at are radioactive politically. Let's not get, you know, let ourselves endanger the larger effort to establish the NSF by getting it involved in political controversy. So what that did is, first of all, it delayed the establishment of the National Science Foundation for a number of years until that fight got sorted out. And then for about a decade, the place of the social sciences on the NSF agenda was the subject of much debate. And finally, towards the end of the 1950s, there was a grudging willingness at NSF to fund some social science research, but it very much was oriented towards funding that social science research that looked the most like the natural sciences, meaning highly quantitative and formal, and oriented towards basic rather than applied research. So it was Talcott Parsons, a sociologist at Harvard and one of the great proponents of the behavioral revolution, who famously said that if the social sciences want to get into the NSF, they're going to have to ride the coattails of the natural sciences. And that very much set, you know, the sort of model for the social sciences about what was a legitimate scientific approach, which increasingly came to exclude policy relevance.
Some academics point to the use of social science in initiatives like Project Camelot as evidence to support their ethical opposition to applied research in support of the state. What is the appropriate relationship between the state and scholar?
Well, you know, I mean, Project Camelot, which was an effort at American University to marshal social science for counterinsurgency and predicting political conflict in the Third World, certainly did not help the effort to make the case that social science should be more broadly relevant. There's no doubt about that. But I think the case of Camelot is not one that suggests there's no way to effectively utilize social science for policymaking without undermining important ethical values. I think the lesson from Camelot had more to do with what happens when you try to wall off social science from the rest of the academy. And mistakes like that, you know, can happen in a situation like with what we saw there. Second thing I would say, though, is there is certainly an ethical obligation of scholars, and indeed, I think, policymakers and everybody else, to be attentive to how what they do affects the lives of people in the United States and around the world. And so it's important to be thinking about those sorts of ethical issues. But as I argue in the book, it's also important from an ethical standpoint for social science to think about what it can positively contribute both to the society in which it operates, but to the larger common weal as well. So, you know, my bottom line is ethical considerations pull in both directions, not only in favor of pulling up the drawbridge of the ivory tower and retreating from engagement with policy, but also with being deeply engaged in it in the right way. And the hero for me on that score was the great German sociologist Max Weber, who in the early 20th century was both one of the most influential scholars in terms of the methodology of the social scientists, but he was also somebody who was regularly engaged in the pressing policy issues of the day in his native Germany. So, you know, I think there's plenty of evidence that suggests that one can be an engaged social scientist and not be a war criminal.
I wanted to address the issue of assumptions. I remember reading that you had looked at course evaluations from your students and their comments on some of the training they received in methods and approaches, and that you'd use their feedback to address the assumption that policymakers would appreciate some of these specialized methods if they only knew more about them. Can you talk about that example? And are there other faulty assumptions that academics make about policymakers or vice versa that contribute to the gap between these groups?
Yeah. Well, you asked if I'm going to take away your numbers as a result of, you know, my work in this area. And the answer is no. I mean, what I found is that, you know, policymakers in the national security realm are not opposed to cutting edge social science. That's not the message at all. Rather, they come to the problems they deal with and how they want to use social science from a very practical standpoint. So if you can make the case that econometrics or game theory or, you know, any of the other sort of cutting edge approaches of social science will help them get a better answer to a policy question, they're all for it. I think the problem is, though, and I, you know, have come to this conclusion, you know, both after teaching for 10 years in graduate public policy programs, but also being in a PhD program in political science here at Notre Dame and at other universities, that increasingly the discipline pursues research techniques, not so much because they are convinced that this will provide a better answer to a pressing real-world problem, but for the opposite reason, that they've concluded that these approaches are the only legitimate way to do science. And so if you're not using these techniques, you're not a scientist. And so it's really a call for problem rather than method-driven research agendas in the academy, and also a recognition that policymakers very much operate under a logic of appropriateness when they look at academic social science. So if they're interested in public opinion in the United States or another country, they're, you know, very happy to utilize work that employs cutting-edge survey techniques and, you know, the best analysis for analyzing the results. But I think what they you know, sort of bristle at, and this is what the students in the public policy programs I taught in is, you know, when they see these approaches being used for their own sake or applied to other substantive questions where they're clearly not applicable. And then they sort of, you know, roll their eyes and, you know, shut down in terms of listening to us.
A contributing factor to the gap between social science and policymakers is the gap between research and actionable use of that research. You mentioned that the field of engineering developed to bridge that gap for natural sciences. What discipline can complement social sciences in that same way?
Well, I mean, that's the $64 million or billion-dollar question. You know, I think the relationship between the natural science disciplines and engineering or medicine, for example, manifests some of the same tensions that we see between international security studies and political science. So I'm not sure engineering is a full panacea for the problem. On the other hand, though, what's interesting is I find myself talking a lot to engineers about how to think about these, you know, larger issues, and finding a lot of resonance in how they look at the world. And so, you know, maybe thinking about international security as the social science equivalent of engineering is not a bad analogy.
You describe many potential causes that may contribute to academic research not addressing policy questions. They range from institutional issues to personal philosophy. Is there one cause that stands out that, if mitigated, would make the biggest impact to bridge the gap between academics and policymakers?
So think a little bit about how a young aspiring PhD in political science is going to make his way in the discipline these days. He's going to have to get a job, his first job or her first job, in a political science department that may have a few IR people in it, but also will have American politics, political theory, and comparative politics folks in it. And these people will have very different views in terms of what's substantively important, but also what's the proper balance between the utilization of cutting-edge techniques and their application to the real world. So to get a job, you got to be able to speak to the discipline of political science as a young person. And then to get promoted in the field, you have to continue to do the same thing. So, you know, is it any surprise that if your whole life is determined by professional political scientists, you're going to be most interested in meeting their criteria and standards for excellence than anything else? So if it were the case that throughout a political scientist's career, that they were evaluated not only by members of the guild, but also by people outside the guild in the areas of government or society to which their research is most relevant, that, I think, would change the incentives very, very dramatically. In other words, if during a 10-year case, it was not only about did you use the most sophisticated techniques? Are you a good social scientist? Did you publish in the right disciplinary journals? But also, is this work right in terms of the way the world really works? And can it help deal with the world's problem? I think the discipline would look very differently if we had to respond to both of those sets of considerations.
Conversely, what could policymakers do to better engage with academia?
Well, I think a lot of policymakers have basically given up on us. And, you know, part of that I know better than, or as well as almost anybody else, is a function of the fact that, you know, we in the ivory tower have become less and less interested in speaking with them. But I also think that policymakers have other places to go to get policy-relevant research. There are all sorts of think tanks in Washington that have people with PhDs, many from very good universities. And also there's the for-profit world, you know, the Beltway bandits and contractors that also hire social scientists. You know, and so those are easy places for the policymaker to go and get the sort of outside expertise that at one time we in academia provided. The problem is, though, that the think tank world has become highly politicized. It's become not a place where serious long-term translational research is done, but it's become more sort of the holding tank for the out-of-work politicos of the party that's out of power in the executive branch. And likewise, the for-profit world has its own set of incentives in terms of the research that they do that leads me to be concerned that if policymakers are just relying on the Beltway bandits, they aren't going to get the best scholarship in the social sciences that's out there. And so I think that they ought to you know, continue to try to engage those of us in the ivory tower, because it'll be hard work and there'll be challenges. But I think the perspectives the university world especially have on many issues are important parts of the larger debate about how we should deal with them.
In your opinion, who of the great political scientists has gotten it right in terms of balancing scholarly rigor and broader relevance?
Well, there are a number of names that I could throw out there. But for me, the guy that was sort of my intellectual hero in this regard was the late Harvard government professor, Sam Huntington, somebody who over the course of a, you know, 60, maybe 70 year career was able to make important contributions in almost every subfield of political science. And he was able to do great scholarship at the same time he was doing work that was of great interest to policymakers in Washington. And I remember my wife and I had dinner with he and his wife, Nancy, at a very nice seafood restaurant in on Martha's Vineyard one summer. And my wife asked Sam, how do you go about thinking about writing a book like The Clash of Civilizations, which is probably the book of his that had the broadest audience? And Sam sat back for a moment and you know, thought about it. And he said, I've always thought that I get the ideas about what to work on from reading the New York Times or reading The Economist. And then I go and I say, this is obviously an important real world problem. How can I analyze it in the most rigorous way possible and come up with answers that'll be useful for dealing with it? And I thought, that's exactly right. That's if the discipline thought about balancing rigor and relevance in that way, in terms of, you know, embracing a problem-oriented agenda for what we work on and how we do it, political science would be exactly where I think it ought to be.
Well, Mike, we've taken up a lot of your time. Before we let you go, would you mind sharing what you're working on now?
Well, I'm working on two things, aside from trying to sell copies of Cult of the Irrelevant, which will be an ongoing objective for me. One issue that I am working on is nuclear strategy. And in a way, that's sort of a return to the golden age of security studies. A lot of the seminal work that Bernard Brody and Thomas Schelling did in the 1950s was focused on the whole question of how should we think about the impact of the nuclear revolution on statecraft. Now, by the time I got into the business in the late 80s and the early 1990s, nuclear issues seemed to have been pretty well worked over. And of course, with the end of the Cold War in the mid-1990s, the urgency of nuclear issues seemed to have waned quite a bit. But recently, nuclear issues are back on the table in a big way, particularly given the possibility of renewed great power conflict between nuclear powers like Russia and especially China. So I'm interested in particular about how the senior figures in the National Command Authority, primarily the president, think about the utility of nuclear weapons in a crisis. So that's one thing that I'm working on. I'm also working on another big project, which I hope will turn into a book, that seeks to understand the paradoxical situation in our secular age in which religion continues to be an important element of national identity. And there are just a whole host of cases from post-Soviet Russia to the BJP in India to the AKP in Turkey to all sorts of places where secular nationalist movements have given way to deeply religiously infused national identities. And that's a puzzle. I mean, we came to believe in the 1950s and 1960s that as the world modernized, it inevitably was going to become more secular. But it hasn't happened in a lot of places, and I'm trying to untangle that paradox.
We wish you the best of luck, and thank you for being on the show today.
It's my pleasure, Beth.
Cult of the Irrelevant, The Waning Influence of Social Science on National Security is available now from Princeton University Press. Thank you for listening to New Books in National Security, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.